Hi, and welcome to this week's edition of the Diplomats Geopolitics Podcast. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
On today's edition of the podcast, we'll be discussing recent events on the Korean Peninsula, which has been quite active this past week. As listeners of this podcast might recall, last week North Korea tested a medium-range ballistic missile as the Nuclear Security Summit was underway in The Hague. Following that, on Monday, reports emerged that both Koreas had exchanged artillery fire and South Korea had scrambled jets in response to the North Korean provocation. Other developments this week include the discovery of North Korean drones, and we'll be discussing that in some detail, determining if that was a threat, if that's an actual threat for South Korea or not. So first to start off with, let's talk about the artillery fire. Zach, you had a piece on this, and I think we had a little bit of a disagreement. So I think Zach and I will kind of go over our respective positions on the issue. So Zach, why don't you tell us what your reading of the situation was? Essentially, my understanding is that you think South Korea firing back against North Korea sets sort of a dangerous precedent.
Yeah, well, sort of. I think that's right. It's not just that what happened in this week's events, it's also sort of the direction South Korea has been taken, which was sort of highlighted in this week's events. Basically, after North Korea's provocations of sinking the South Korean warship and shelling its islands in 2010, South Korea vowed to take a more proactive stance and always respond to North Korea's provocations. And this is pretty new in my understanding of it, because South Korea has, throughout its history, really let North Korea mainly get away with a lot of these provocations. So I think South Korea's newfound determination to respond fairly aggressively to when North Korea provokes it is potentially very destabilizing, even though it's quite understandable. I should emphasize that I completely understand South Korea's position, and it's entirely defensible. But because North Korea has been getting away with these provocations, and because the fact it's committing these is somewhat tied up into its regime security, the fact that when South Korea now plans to respond, that I think would be very destabilizing over the long run. I particularly highlight South Korea's active deterrence policy and the procurement, the weapons procurement that surround it. The active deterrence policy, as we've talked about on the site, basically says that South Korea is going to build an attack system to swiftly neutralize North Korea's nuclear and missile tests. So basically, it's building the surveillance and reconnaissance capabilities and the missile capabilities to launch preemptive strikes that aim to take out North Korea's ability to launch nuclear missiles or missiles in general against South Korea. So there's a crisis and if South Korea determines that North Korea is getting ready to launch a nuclear missile or just a heavy ballistic missile against it, it's going to try to preempt that by taking out all of North Korea's missile and nuclear sites. And this, I think, is going to be fairly problematic because, and, you know, during crises, as you know very well, Ankit, North Korea likes to do things like test missiles as to show its anger and to sort of posture itself to prevail in this crisis or whatever. So there's not going to be really a way for South Korea to tell if North Korea is getting ready to do a missile launch or if it's getting ready to attack South Korea. So if its policy is one of preemption, it's going to be attacking even if North Korea is simply just trying to test a missile. And also, North Korea, I believe, pays attention to South Korea's statements, so it now thinks that South Korea is going to be trying to preempt its nuclear missile sites, and it doesn't have a very big nuclear arsenal, and it's not likely to really acquire a very large one simply because of economic constraints. So it's going to have an incentive to kind of adopt a use it or lose it nuclear doctrine, because if it doesn't use these nukes quickly, it's going to feel that that South Korea is going to destroy them in a first strike. So that's my take on it.
Absolutely. No, I feel like you made some very valid points there. I think the main part where I disagree is just to the extent that to which it necessarily has to be destabilizing. I agree with you that there's a potential that this can be destabilizing. I mean, preemptive strikes are a very dangerous tactical tool to play with. I mean, you know, there's examples of preemptive attacks causing an escalatory spiral. I just want to get your sense of that. I mean, the piece that I wrote in response to your take of the situation, I focused a lot on, you know, the arithmetic of the actual exchange, the proportionality of the exchange. And I essentially, you know, wasn't too worried, essentially, because I showed that South Korea essentially preserved proportionality. They didn't strike back against any North Korean assets, either on land or sea, because that could have led to an escalation. And I think that as long as South Korea keeps up that sort of tit-for-tat response and North Korea kind of recognizes that this is the new normal on the peninsula, as you say in your article, I think things can be stabilized. I mean, I wanted to get your take on that. What's your take on, the potential for escalation?
Yeah, well, no, I grant you that it very well could help deterrence in some regard, because if North Korea knows – I mean, North Korea's fact that it knows it can kind of get away with this stuff probably encourages it to undertake these actions. So in that way, like, it's possible that South Korea's new determination will eventually act as a deterrent towards North Korea's provocations. But the thing is that with proportionality, especially, like, you got to be careful, because what we see in South Korea and normal people see is a tit for tat. Like, North Korea might have a different perspective, especially because it's so used to there not being a response. So any response to it looks like kind of an escalation. And also, so this time North Korea had just shelled like the waters across the maritime division, and it didn't cause any damage to South Korea. So South Korea shelled the waters in North Korea side, and it didn't cause any damage. But say, like, for instance, North Korea shells another South Korean island, or if it sinks a warship or something, then South Korea's proportional response would be to start attacking North Korea.
Yeah. I absolutely know. Like, I pointed that out in my piece. Actually, that's the huge problem with proportionality. It's subjective. I mean, how do you determine, you know, how many ships you take in response for sinking either another ship or a nuclear facility? You know, it's hard to kind of make those comparisons between assets. And you know, like, with North Korea, you're absolutely right that they could perceive things very differently than we do. And in fact, the fact that South Korea responded at all this time could be, you know, disproportional in a sense. But fortunately, you know, that wasn't the case. I think it'll be interesting to watch. I mean, I agree with you that South Korea has made a change in its policy in the way that it responds to North Korea from now on. And from here on out, it'll be interesting to see if South Korea responds to every single North Korean provocation, which I find to be unlikely, or it, you know, responds after a series of provocations. And I think in this case, we've kind of seen the latter, because there have been a series of missile tests and other provocations by North Korea leading up to the South responding. And it might be, you know, it sends a signal essentially to the North that enough is enough. And I think the North kind of recognizes that. There's kind of this unspoken charade that goes on between the two Koreas right now. And I think that's what we're going to see from here on out.
Yeah, if I could just highlight one thing we forgot to mention, is that there, besides the active deterrence policy, one thing that President Park did soon after taking office was decentralize command and control over responding to North Korean provocations. So she basically said to commanders on the ground, on the front lines of North Korea, that you can respond as you see fit. Don't worry about the political implications. Yeah. So now we also have a situation where South Korea's operational commanders can now respond without the political leadership. And the other dynamic I think we should highlight is that the U.S. no longer really seems to have much control, or at least it looks like U.S. is progressively losing more and more control over South Korea's defense policies, especially towards North Korea.
Yeah, that's something Robert Gates talks about in his book, how the Pentagon had to rein back the South Koreans on several occasions.
Yeah. Can I do that in the future now?
Absolutely. Well, great. I think that was a pretty interesting debate. I think we'll, you know, see things from here on out. I guess it's up to listeners to decide who won that exchange, Zach. Next, I guess let's talk very quickly about, South Korea's changes to its ballistic missiles. Zach, you wrote a bit about this today, so why don't you want to update our listeners on what South Korea is doing?
Yeah, so basically, South Korea has always had these bilateral agreements with the U.S., that constrained how the range on South Korea's domestically made ballistic missiles. It used to be 150 kilometers with payloads of, I think, 300 kilograms. And then in 2001, there was a new bilateral agreement between U.S. and South Korea, where South Korea was allowed to build ballistic missiles with 300 kilometers ranges and payloads no larger than 500 kilograms. Then in October of 2012, they signed an updated version of this agreement where South Korea could extend the range of its ballistic missiles to as much as 800 kilometers with a 500 kilogram payload, or could have a bigger payload on shorter missiles, shorter range missiles. So basically what the 800 kilometer range would give South Korea the ability to attack all of North Korea with ballistic missiles from basically most of South Korea's territory. It also was short enough so that it wouldn't be able to really threaten China and Japan, which was a key consideration for the U.S. So basically this week, following the medium-range ballistic missile test from the North last week, South Korea this week announced that it had tested a 500-kilometer ballistic missile that it had just built. So this is a new ballistic missile South Korea built, range of 500 kilometers, and then it said that it's still planning on building these 800-kilometer ballistic missiles. And I think the reports that I've seen said that originally it was going to build the 800-kilometer range ballistic missiles by the end of 2017, and now it looks like it'll have them by next year. So this is, again, part of this strategy of active deterrence.
Yeah. How do you think this will alter the North's behavior, if at all?
I think that it will fear that its nuclear sites are under grave threat, because it built its nuclear sites, a lot of them, and some of the missile sites in the northern part of the country, kind of on the border of where North Korea meets China and meets Russia, and did this partly so that attacks against its nuclear sites would possibly affect China and Russia, so it would deter, like, say, the U.S. from carrying out these strikes, hopefully.
Yeah.
And then also it built them so they're out of the range of South Korea's missiles, and now they're no longer will be outside of the range of South Korea's missiles.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I wonder if Seoul's ultimate strategy here is to be able to counter all of North Korea's ballistic and artillery installations. You know, we all know that in the incident of a war, of a resumption of war between the two Koreas, the North has significant artillery facilities and ballistic missiles targeted at Seoul. Mm-hmm. And its idea is that it would be able to strike Seoul within, I think it's 30 minutes to an hour or something like that, and cause devastating damage. That's something that, you know, kind of keeps the South a little bit restrained. And I wonder, you know, if the South is trying to develop an ability now to be able to wipe out those artillery installations faster than the North can actually operationalize them against Seoul.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely the goal. It's also building, I should mention, it's building a kill chain. I think it's called the whole system a kill chain system, but it also, part of the system is missile defense. So basically its goal is to preemptively strike as many of these sites as possible, and then have a very robust ballistic or missile defense system to try to destroy any of the ones it misses. So, and again, like, this could be, it's basically South Korea's way of using conventional weapons to negate North Korea's nuclear arsenal, but at the same time, for North Korea, it's also a way for South Korea to kind of, like, render its deterrent ineffective. It's both conventional and nuclear, and that would make it worry, I think, about South Korea trying to forcibly unify the country.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, the only problem I see here is that, you know, this kind of deterrence sort of necessitates a first strike. If you don't strike first, you allow the North to strike you first. And, I mean, and in that scenario, this kind of strategy kind of falls apart. So I wonder if, you know, South Korea will, in the future, consider a first strike against North Korea if there's credible evidence that the North is planning an attack. That could be interesting.
I mean, that's what the active deterrence is. It's saying it's going to take a preemptive strike. The problem is that it's hard, very hard to tell if North Korea is actually about to attack it, or if it's putting missiles on sites just to, like, bluff, or if it's about to take a missile test.
Yeah.
And I also think just that this whole strategy of South Korea preemptive strikes, I mean, this leaves out the U.S., presumably. And if South Korea is going to take this dangerous strategy of preempting and trying to eliminate all North Korea's nuclear and long-range missiles and a lot of its artillery, I mean, I think the U.S. would be better served if the U.S. was integrated in this plan, because the U.S. has a lot of capabilities to bring to bear to make this strategy at least successful if it's going to be taken out.
Right, absolutely. I think we'll see that evolve slowly over time. I mean, South Korea is definitely taking the lead on their own active deterrence policy. That's not surprising, but I think we'll see increased cooperation between the South and the United States, I think, going forward.
Yeah, hopefully. That definitely needs to be done, but I haven't seen many U.S. officials even really discuss this active deterrence. I'm sure it's happening behind the scenes, but I haven't really seen much in public.
Mm, yeah. Very shortly, another incident that occurred between the Koreas this week that's been attracting quite a bit of attention is that two North Korean drones were found crashed on the South Korean side of the border. And one of these drones had crashed, I think, a little over a week ago, and the other one crashed on Monday after the artillery exchange. And this has been prompting a lot of speculation about North Korea potentially pursuing an asymmetric strategy with the development of drones and the potential for North Korea using drones in a sort of kamikaze-style suicide attack, either involving biological or chemical agents or conventional explosives. And I have a piece up on the site now. It just went up a few hours ago, so I'm sure most people haven't read it yet. But essentially, you know, I point out that most of these drones, the specific models that crashed are incredibly rudimentary. And for them to be able to carry explosives and still penetrate South Korean air defenses and radar undetected, they'd have to be much larger. And the problem with drones is the larger you get, the easier you are to detect. So, yes, it's true that these two rudimentary small drones managed to make it past radar. They probably flagged up as false positives, honestly, but it's very unlikely that this will pose a longer-term threat to South Korean security. I mean, nonetheless, South Korea is taking this very seriously and responding by acquiring better technology to counter these sorts of drones, you know, low-altitude surveillance radars and anti-aircraft guns. But I think in the long term, this is being a little bit overblown as a threat. I mean, with North Korea, always the preeminent threats will remain its artillery, ballistic missiles, and nuclear weapons program. Agree with that, Zach?
Yeah, that seems correct to me. I mean, I think it's somewhat worrying just because even though these are small drones, you know, if you'd expect South Korea's radar, presumably along the demilitarized zone, to be a little bit better at detecting them.
Yeah.
But you're right that, like, drones are just hard to penetrate. It's hard for drones to penetrate areas. I don't see North Korea building sophisticated enough drones, like stealth drones, to get through South Korean airspace. And I will say also that this is like such a typical North Korean kind of tactic. You know, they used to build those tunnels, and you know, it's just very asymmetrical, just like North Korea's typical strategies since during the Cold War.
Yeah, no, absolutely makes sense. I mean, especially given that North Korea's conventional abilities are just absolutely outdated and stand no match. So they have to think outside the box.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know if in this day and age using drones is even thinking outside the box. It seems to be a worldwide
It's all the
trend.
Rage, really.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's why this story's been so big, is that just, you know, people are fascinated by drones in general.
Yeah, and you know, just to rant for a second, I mean, the way we use the word drone, I feel like a lot of people start equating, you know, Global Hawks with $300 drones that you can buy on Amazon, and everything just kind of blurs together. Mm-hmm. And the word drone just sounds terrifying. You know, we imagine that the same things that are hunting down Al-Qaeda and Taliban agents are, you know, being deployed by North Korea against South Korea, which is just absolutely not true.
Yeah, it's absurd.
I guess just before we end this week's podcast, we thought we'd discuss the burgeoning split between North Korea and China. And Zach, I believe you've written a bit about this and you've been thinking about this a lot. So why don't you tell us, you know, what's happening between these two partners?
You know, it's always hard to tell with China and North Korea's bilateral relations. They've both kept close to the chest usually. But there was a report last week by a South Korean media agency that North Korea had hung banners in one of its military academies. It's called China a turncoat and our enemy, which was a phrase that Kim Il-sung, North Korea's ex-internal president, like, had used in 1992 after China and South Korea established bilateral relations. And then it's been, like, carried back. The North Korean regime has kind of brought it back every once in a while to express its displeasure with China at various points. And then on Thursday, the Global Times, a Chinese state-run newspaper, published an editorial that really kind of attacked North Korea in unusually stark terms. It was focused mainly on the North Korea's threat to conduct a new kind of nuclear test, but it actually went, I'd say, much further. It started criticizing North Korea. It said, like, if North Korea continues on its nuclear path, it'll always live in poverty. And North Korea just blasted South Korea's president for stating that North Korea lives in poverty. A lot of North Korean citizens live in poverty. And it just really lashed out the North, and this is just kind of part of a growing escalation. The UN Security Council, with China's acquiescence, condemned North Korea's medium-range ballistic missile tests last week. China also has come out on a number of occasions now forcefully to back South Korea President Park's new initiative to ease the way for reunification. By contrast, North Korea has absolutely blasted Park for making a speech in Germany calling for unification. It said that,
right,
she had been disgraced to the Korean nation. And then also I just add that North Korea hasn't been completely complacent in this, and that it's been opening a dialogue with Japan, which China is obviously very – a country China is very wary about right now. And then it also – it looks like there's new reports out yesterday that says that the licenses – North Korea has been strengthening the licenses it's requiring for exports to China. And this was expected in the wake of the purge of Kim Jong-un's uncle, Jang.
So. Very interesting, yeah. I mean, it seems like Kim Jong-un won't be getting that trip to Beijing anytime soon.
Certainly not.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just to add something to that, I think, you know, I think China is getting to the point where, you know, their ideal scenario always with North Korea has been to have a functional state that's predictable, but, you know, an all-weather partner for China. And North Korea really hasn't been that way. I think particularly we saw that with the execution of Jang Song-taek, which made things a lot more unpredictable between the two countries. I mean, Jang was kind of China's point man in Pyongyang, according to a lot of people. And now, I mean, you're absolutely right that the situation is starting to look a lot more unpredictable between these two countries.
Yeah, I will say, though, that I mean, I think ultimately China is just, I mean, it's still terrified of a breakdown of North Korea, I would say. I don't think it'll fundamentally alter its policy towards North Korea. And this has been ongoing. It's more odd that it's so public now. But I mean, there's always been tension between China and North Korea. It's very intense. So, I mean, I don't know exactly how much to make of it, but it certainly is interesting.
Yeah, it'll be a trend to watch.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think that's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week with more.
Thanks.